Hello and welcome to Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 364. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
I'm so tired.
And James Jones.
I was not here last week, but neither were you.
I think we're probably all tired today because we're still recovering from New Year's Eve. So Happy New Year, everybody. It is our first...
I am debauched.
This is our first episode of 2014. Still feels a little weird to say that, but...
It's only the second, come on!
This is going into our eighth year of Radio Free Nintendo, and I love that. So, unfortunately, of course, John is not here tonight. He is just getting super busy with real life stuff, so he may be kind of off and on for the next few weeks as things settle down a little bit for him. I think something similar happened about this time last year. Just coincidentally, but we may get some guests on sometimes. He may pop in every now and then over the next couple months, but we're going to move on forward here tonight with just the three of us. So, just so you know, because John isn't here, and I do want him to be here for it, we're going to wait to do our top fives of 2013. I think we kind of started working on it, but then when I found out about John not being around, I said, oh, we'll wait. Because I want the four of us to really do that together.
To yell at each other.
So hopefully next week. But this episode, we're going to do some emails later in the show, including some really, really good ones. So anyway, we're going to kick off with new business. And I guess I'll go first with Attack of the Friday Monsters for 3DS. And James played this too, so we'll tag team it.
I also played that maybe 8 months ago?
That's right, yeah.
A while ago,
I don't think it was that long ago, but yeah, I remember you talking about it, and you seem to like it quite a bit.
Yeah, indeed. It's probably the best one of the three Gildo 2 titles. I recently got Bugs vs. Tanks because it was also on sale, and let's just say that...
Bugs vs. Tanks.
Let's just say that it's the weakest of the three, and I'm probably never touching it again after playing maybe an hour.
It is my understanding that it lives down to its name.
Yep. It does. Okay.
Well, I dodged a bullet there, but I did pick up Attack of the Friday Monsters when it was recently on sale for $5, and I really liked it. I really didn't quite know what to expect, even though I'd heard, you know, Guillaume's description. It's just, it's not a kind of game I've ever really played before, and I just didn't know if I would like it at all. It seems like barely removed from a visual novel like, you know, Phoenix Wright or 999, but you do have direct control over the character.
Right.
And it's just, it's very childish, you know, it's very like nostalgic, I guess, for a very specific period in the early 1970s in Japan, which I can't relate to at all. So I'm like, I don't know if I am going to enjoy this, but I really, really did. I think it's lovely. It's very charming. Nice graphics, especially the backgrounds, which are all kind of hand painted or maybe hand drawn, with like pieces of CG, I think, but it all blends together in a very painterly kind of a way. They just look fantastic. And the setting is just very lovely, a little sweet little, suburb, I guess, of Tokyo. And I just love the way it looked. I thought the music was superb and really fit the setting very nicely. It had a very nostalgic, kind of dreamlike summertime feel to it. And I thought the story really, to me, really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Even if I follow it literally, I don't think it really has a whole lot going on. But I still found I enjoyed it. You know, there's a lot of mystery to it. And as I made my way through it, I was kind of held in minor fits of suspense by what was going on, even if it didn't pay off in the end.
The whole time it feels like it's a child's imagination. This is the world as colored by the imagination of children. And these children have been fed by what was the popular television show of Japan in that particular era, which is the sort of giant hero versus giant monster sort of craze that had sort of taken over Japanese television.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's appropriate content in the year that we got Pacific Rim.
yeah.
Although this is a much more fanciful, childlike version of it. But still, you know, this has a lot more in common with something like Ultraman. But
yeah.
Even Ultraman, I think, as a fairly well-known example of what you're talking about, the TV series, is still very obscure for a Western audience. So I don't really have a whole lot of connection to that stuff, but I kind of like the idea of playing this sort of small town short story kind of video game. That's exactly what I felt about it.
Yeah, it's kind of a slice of life game, which is a relatively popular genre in Japan, but at the same time, it has this weird, monsters versus heroes thing thrown on top of it. Gives it a layer of whimsy.
Yeah, and even more than that, you know, the sort of gameplay part of it, I guess, where you're collecting these cards to play a card game with other characters, it's really like the most mechanics-heavy part of the game. And,
yep.
And it, Guillaume, I remember you describing it. I can't remember if you actually thought it had much going on for it.
Oh,
but
no.
I thought the game actually was kind of neat once I figured out what was going on with
it. There is a layer of strategy to it, because how it works is you pick five cards, and each of them represents basically one of the three rock, paper, scissors symbols. And what happens?
They look like Magic the Gathering or Pokemon cards.
Yeah.
But the rules are much, much simpler.
Yeah, you pick five, your opponent picks five, and you just lay them face down. And essentially, your first card battles their first card, your second, their second, all the way through the fifth. And after it lays them all out, it tells you how many you're winning, how many they're winning, and how many are draws. It then tells you explicitly a couple of them. And then both you and your opponent swap cards to try to maximize your advantage.
Right.
Essentially, you want to be the person who has the most wins.
Yeah, it reminds me a lot of the card mini games in, was it Final Fantasy VII or VIII when those debuted? And they did two or three of it in a row.
Right.
And I really enjoyed those, especially the first one that they did. I liked that one a lot.
Triple Triad?
Triple Triad. So
yeah, it's
kind
of... This
one's a little bit simpler than that, but it captures sort of the same feel in a shorter span of time.
I actually like the fact that it tells you if you're winning or losing, and then it gives you the opportunity to make adjustments. But the person who's losing gets to adjust after the person who's winning. So there's a certain layer of strategy to it.
Oh, there's a lot, really.
So
even though it is random as well, but...
It is.
No, I thought that was clever. And, you know, even though it is kind of a mini game, I mean, this whole game is so short that the mini game ends up feeling like a significant portion of it. And, you know, to me, this game almost is like... You know, it has an element of like Animal Crossing or something like that, in that, you know, there's not really that much you're playing. You're just kind of walking around and viewing it,
right.
And watching it go forward. But I enjoyed that part of it, and I like that it is kind of compact, and you finish the whole thing in like 2 or 3 hours. So it's very self-contained, and I really do appreciate that. At least sometimes I like that. Overall, I have to say the game actually kind of reminded me of like Earthbound if you took out the battles. You know, it has a similar kind of a really quirky sense of humor, a really sweet story about, you know, kind of told from a child's perspective on larger, weirder things going on.
Right.
And I felt it was kind of, you know, there were so many interesting little side characters and mysterious little subplots. And it really reminded me of running around the towns in Earthbound and talking to people and, you know, trying to figure out what is going on in this weird story.
Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, as an adult playing the game, you know more than the kids do. So it's just amusing to see how they interpret the things going on around them. And you think that you know better, but maybe you don't. Like, because the plot has quite a few twists.
I agree with you. Yeah, I think it plays with that somewhat condescending perspective that you might have over the very young characters here. At least we as adults might feel that way playing it. And it toys around with that a little bit and subverts your expectations. So I really did enjoy that part of it. I think that's very sophisticated storytelling, especially for a handheld game. You don't always expect that kind of... just experimentation, I guess, in the way the story is told.
Right. I really hope that Level 5 brings out a Guild 03 at some point. Because the eShop, there's been kind of a dearth of games recently. I don't know if it's just because, you know, I've got a short memory or something, but since SteamWorld Dig, there's not really been a big title that really, like, everyone is, that every, you know, 3DS player is talking about.
Mm. I think Edge would be making more of a splash if the Wii U version hadn't come out a couple weeks earlier.
Yeah, and that had a PC version that came out years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's been around for a while, but still. I mean, I think it's very well suited to the platform, but I already bought it on Wii U, so I'm not going to buy it again on 3DS.
Yeah, same here.
Why don't we move on, James, to what you've been playing?
Yeah, so when I bought the PS3 that I got, I deliberately acquired the more expensive backwards compatible one. Because I personally never owned a PS2. And what I had bought a while ago was I bought Persona 3 FES on the PlayStation Store, not realizing that it's going to take like 20 gigs to install the dumb thing. Because everything on the PlayStation Store takes at least 20 gigs. So I installed it. I started playing it pretty 20 much.
20 gig PS2 game. That's...
Yeah, it's dumb.
What the hell?
I started playing it pretty much as soon as we finished talking that night, and so that was 2 weeks ago today. In the interim, I have logged about 44 hours.
Oh my god.
Well, of course, the thing here is I was off for those 2 weeks. I had actually already been off for like 4 days when we recorded, and I've been off basically all the way through last Monday, so I had plenty of late nights I was able to play and not worry about it. And I could play during the day if I wanted to. That whole conversation we had about things like eye strain and overplaying a game too much, I fucked that up. Couple things. One, your eyes are muscles, and or they have muscles in them. And just like any other muscles, if you don't work them out a lot, they can get a little tired. Their stamina goes down. And I'm pretty far removed from the time of my life where I marathoned game sessions. And it hit me. It hit me a little bit. But so I enjoy it. It's a weird game to describe. I know Guillaume played the portable version of it, right?
Right. But I've been
which
told...
is a significantly different game, apparently.
Yeah, like I've heard, I had a pretty bad experience with it. I guess part of it was playing it after 4, which I really find superior in every way. But also, like, they cut out a lot of stuff, which to me on paper sound like improvements, like you're dealing less with running around in the school and stuff like that. It's mostly like menus in the portable version. You don't go to someone and talk to them. You just click on them. And that sounded good to me, but some people have been telling me, no, it's really something is lost.
I can see the allure of that, and I can see why they would do that on a portable version. But what I feel like that probably does is it probably removes you from the setting.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think being in the setting actually makes that whole like support mechanic and stuff work.
Right. Yeah.
I think if you remove everybody from the context of the world they operate in, their your interactions with them wouldn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And I could see why you would do that, because you do spend a significant amount of time just running from place to place, and sometimes that can feel really old. But if you break down the world into just essentially a table where you select the one you want, I feel like it would sort of break everything else besides moving around. So it's a trade-off. So there are times certainly where I feel like, God, I wish I could just say I want to go to the Iwatodai Station. I don't want to have to run through every part of the school to get to exit.
Yeah.
But there are times where running through the school gave you the opportunity to encounter things that you would have otherwise missed.
I think in Persona 4 Golden on Vita, there you can sort of skip to a. I think you can do it either way. In terms of moving around.
I think that's probably for the best. I do think if you constantly use skipping around, you'll probably miss some stuff.
Yeah. Well, it's good that we're talking about Persona. This franchise is finally coming to Nintendo platforms.
It is.
I believe for the first time, although it seems to be isn't the 3DS game that they announced kind of a Persona for babies or something?
It's
what?
A spinoff.
No.
So it stars the characters of Persona 3 and 4.
But aren't they like chibi-fied or something like that?
A little bit.
Sure, yeah. Sure. But it's like the style of Etrian Odyssey, which is awesome.
Yeah.
And definitely not for babies.
All right.
Isn't it basically an Etrian Odyssey game?
That's what I'm reading, yeah. It's from the same director.
Persona Q, I think is what it's called.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Now, well, to be fair, they didn't actually say very much about it. But,
no, they didn't.
I watched
the
video.
Persona
and
games in like a 20-minute window. They were They didn't say much about any of the games they announced.
I mean, I think we're better off than the Vita people who are getting that dancing...
Yeah, who are getting a Project Miku game. So... if you know nothing about the franchise, you missed Guillaume's talking about it. The basic concept is you play a student in high school in a world that at midnight every night is overtaken by these shadows, and the vast majority of people sleep through it. So only a handful of people can actually perceive them.
Not only they sleep through it, but they become coffins.
In fucking coffins, yes. Yeah. So for 1 hour, the only thing keeping these shadows from completely destroying the world are these handful of people who are able to, A, stay awake and perceive them, and B, summon these sort of expressions of themselves, these monsters that they refer to as personas. So the world is basically two-part, of you sort of exploring your world during the daytime, and then at night going to your school, where essentially is sort of the nexus point for these things.
Now, is Persona 3 far enough back that the characters are still shooting themselves in the head to go to
Oh, yeah. They are still shooting themselves in the head.
Yeah. Yeah, they got rid of that in 4.
They're very
I can
clear.
I only imagine why.
They're very clear at the beginning. These aren't guns. They're activators. But like, they still make gun sounds. And they still look like guns.
Yep.
So it's despite your
What's
best
up,
efforts.
ESRB?
Yeah, 33 hours after the first time you've told me they're activators, I've sort of just gotten used to people shooting themselves in the head. What's interesting about the game for me personally is that there's all these sorts of managing tasks you have to take care of. You know, every month there's a boss, and you know what day it's coming. Well, every lunar month, so every 28 days. You know exactly when that boss is coming. There's a little countdown telling you when it's coming. And there's a section of the school, which at night becomes this giant tower seemingly going on forever, that you can sort of explore during that month. There's like a block of it. So you have to manage exploring that block tower in that time frame and gaining enough experience to deal with the boss. But you don't necessarily know what that boss is, what it's going to be weak against, you know, until you get there. So you're having to manage keeping enough of your party leveled up enough that regardless of what the boss is, you can put together a party that's elementally capable of dealing with it. Hmm. You also have to manage things like social skills, exhaustion. Like if you run people to death, you know, they're not going to be able to fight. You can get sick. You have to manage things like your academics. There's all sorts of these things where you have to sort of time manage, where you're going, okay, I've got 6 days left. I've explored as much of the tower as I'm going to. Do I want to just put all this time into other stuff? Or do I want to try to keep going to the tower to get stronger? It's sort of a juggling game, and I kind of like that. It sort of,
if you remember, Reseteer had a lot of that kind of stuff.
It does. Yeah. It's a lot of the same stuff. So while the tower itself is just randomly generated levels full of monsters, the opportunity to do other things sort of makes that work. Because if it was, you had to go to the tower every night, it would be really dry and boring.
Mm-hmm.
But there's sort of this like, okay, today I'm going in there. I need to make the most of it. So you're pushing yourself to the absolute limit of how much you can do. And then on the next day, you're like, all right, so I'm not going. I need to make today count and do other stuff. I kind of like that sort of everything you do has consequence.
Yeah.
And the game itself has enough of a sense of humor that regardless of how dry what you're doing ultimately sounds on paper, just the world around you is so stupid that it's kind of a joy anyway. So I'm in like the 10th month, I think, and I just had final exams. So for a week, a straight week of the game time, you don't get to do anything except go to class and they'll ask you one trivia question based on the lectures you watched through the last couple months.
Yeah.
And your intelligence or your academic score, i.e. how much you've been studying throughout the game, will determine how many of the questions you get a chance to answer. And then at the end of that, it affects what place you had on the school's exam score, which then affects whether or not people like you. It's so ridiculous, but I just sort of enjoy doing its ridiculous dumbness. The nice part about the game, though, is I can have something running on my laptop, like a video, like a YouTube video, and just sort of, you know, I can give enough attention to exploring the tower.
Oh, it's a multitasker.
It is. So if you're in the tower, once you sort of get a feel for a section of the tower, you know what the enemies are, you know what they're weak against, you can sort of half pay attention to that and half pay attention to something else. And the problem with multitaskers like that is because you don't have to give them everything you've got, you end up just blowing out hours without realizing you've done it.
It's happened to me with every single Pokemon game that I've played.
Yep. I had one day of I finished all my Christmas shopping. I finished all of the home improvement tasks I wanted to do. And I got up around 10 that day because I was off, whatever. I started playing around to 11, and I look up, and it's night. And I'm like, uh-oh. And it's not like sundown. It's like deep into night at this point.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, oh, boy. I just blew like 8 hours. And like, all right. All right, game. I'm done for the day. And then I found myself a couple hours later coming back and playing again.
Picross 3D is the other game that does that to me. And I think it's because it's a number game. And so I found that I could play it really well, but still listen to audio podcasts of just people talking because they just use different parts of my brain. And so I would just mainline that shit for like 6, 7, 8 hours at a time of playing Picross 3D. And like my hands are cramping up, you know, from using the stylus.
Yep.
But I've just caught up on my entire backlog of podcasts. And then I would like be in withdrawal for a week. And I'd have to let it build back up and go through it all over again.
Yes, I had like I had like old episodes of Mystery Science Theater playing on my laptop on Netflix as I'm just running through them. So when you'd get out of the tower and you had to do story
stuff,
like
I'd triple tasking because
Mystery
Science Theater, I mean, you really have to like watch it and listen to it really carefully.
I've pretty much seen all the episodes that are on Netflix at least once, so a lot of times it's just kind of like, hey, I remember that joke. I really enjoy these games. But I did find that I needed a little bit of a break between, you know, these really big marathon sessions. I need something a lot more tactile and active. And I got that when I went to a play and trade that's in our little shopping district in town. It's the only one in town now. And they had Ace Combat 4 and 5 for $4 and $5. And I'm like, well, shit, here we go. This is why I bought a backwards compatible PS2, so I could get these games that are dirt cheap.
So you could get these deals.
That I missed out on, and I just bought them and went home and proceeded to play through each of them concurrent or successively.
If you can find PS2 games on a shelf anywhere, they're probably super cheap.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, that system's old enough that places like GameStop, they don't even sell those games
anymore. They don't, no. But
they don't have GameCube like, games or Xbox.
Places like Play and Trade
still
sell like NES games, so they're there. The only time you run into a PS2 game that's really expensive is if it was a super rare game, like the third Dot Hack game. Where it's like $8 for the first, $10 for the second, $80 for the third.
I think Dark Cloud 2 is pretty rare.
Yeah, it is. So those games, they are what they are. They're Ace Combat games. They have this ridiculous narrative where you, as one fighter pilot who never talks, just goes on a rampage and turns back an insurmountable military opponent on their own, while around you this completely asinine and over-the-top plot spins. And by the end of it, everybody's basically referring to you as a god, and you're stopping a satellite that's loaded with nuclear missiles from falling on a city with an airplane. You're shooting down a satellite descending from orbit in an airplane.
Oh, so James, we were talking before the show, but you know, it's funny, you were joking about how your new business is so Japanese, and I'm thinking, I guess I don't usually think of Ace Combat games as being that crazy over the top Japanese, because when I think of them, and keep in mind, I've barely played any of them, but when I think of them, I always get this image of like an F-16 or an F-18 fighter jet. And that image is so American to me, even though, of course, many, many different countries use those planes. It just makes me think of Top Gun. And so I associate Ace Combat with Top Gun, which is like the most stupidly American thing I can conjure.
These
but Ace Combat is like an anime, basically.
Yeah,
it's so Japanese.
It's basically the anti-Top Gun. Because, like, whereas Top Gun's just like, yep, there's some dudes from unknown country, let's shoot them down. These games decide they're going to spin out these political intrigues as you're a fighter pilot, you don't care that country A has decided to invade country B as a cover for their attempt to take over the whatever so they can destroy the other two countries.
But you're going to hear all of it.
But you're going to hear all about it, and usually while you're in the middle of, like, 20 SU-37s trying to shoot you down. Like, there's people just coming over your radio just screaming at you about things. I'm like, I'm busy.
Yeah, please. You know, people like to make fun of Call of Duty in the way that it has these kind of very disjointed storylines for its campaign modes. But I think the way that game chops up the information in the background and it gives you very, very few clues to go on to actually string the whole plot from end to end, I think that's probably more realistic for a military story. You know, like if you're a soldier on the ground, and that's kind of the whole point of Call of Duty, is they really want to put you in that, in, right, you know, in a named character who's really there in that situation. You know, I think that's probably more the perspective that they have. They only get bits and pieces, and it's hard to follow. Whereas, like you said, in Ace Combat, it's like you're the president, but you're also flying on the front lines. You know, it's like, you know, everything about what's going on, but you're deep in the shit too.
In 5, you actually rescue the president at one point, and he's just talking to you like nothing's up. What's up? Hey. I mean, I think to an extent, a fighter pilot probably would have more perspective than a foot soldier, because he goes back to his base at the end of battle and watches TV.
That's a good point.
But, like, there are people, like, getting on the radio screaming at you, like, I need you to fly 3,000 miles now to shoot down a satellite. And the rest of your team's like, what? No, we can't do that. And you're just like, whatever. All right, sure, let's go do it. Cool, guys. Have fun. What I will say from playing 4 and 5 is I can kind of chart the progression of how the series has evolved. One thing that they've really tacked down is that there's no continues in these games, which you say, well, you know, whatever. But some of these missions are really long. In 4, a lot of the missions are just like, hey, you have 15 minutes, do as much damage as you can. And then after that 15 minutes, you may get stuck in the dogfight for a little while. But if you crash, guess what? You got to replay that whole stupid 15 minutes.
Ugh, that's like the... That's the boss rush level all over again.
Yeah, but 5 got rid of those, here's 15 minutes, do a bunch of damage, and just replace them with, hey, go here, do stuff, go here, do stuff. But you still have to replay everything if you crash. But by 0, it sounds like they've put in continues. They sort of managed. So it is interesting to watch, you know, refinements, you know, be able to see a series go through its refinements, you know, over the course of a week, just sort of hammering through and going, okay. They saw that and said, well, that's stupid. Let's fix that. And they went into this. Or you could see things they take out because they don't work. In 5, you control your wingman with the D-pad, but occasionally people will come on the radio and ask you yes-no questions. And sometimes it's just kind of amusing because they're like, hey, can you hear me? And you say no, and then they yell at you. Obviously, you can hear me. But other times, it influences the game. And while that's cool and all, a lot of times they talk, I'm busy. Because I am racking up like 65 kills in one flight box. I don't have time to answer your stupid questions about whether or not I like the song the other soldiers are singing. I'm busy. Maybe you should be busier too. Just a thought. And so they dial that back in later games, but it was an interesting experiment to try, and it does affect some levels of the campaign, but ultimately it just doesn't work. So I did enjoy watching that series evolve from 4, which just feels very primitive. Even though it looks good. I mean, it's a PS2 game, but it still looks pretty good.
The whole series is like a kind of a graphic showcase.
Yeah. The plot in 4 is considered to be one of the better ones. But it's just... The gameplay is so primitive compared to where the series ends up that it's kind of a neat evolution to track. And it was a good breakup for Persona 3's just... grind straight ahead and do what you have to do to go through these like 10-minute missions where you drop 1,000 bombs and just go ape shit on an entire enemy army. You know, it's a nice change of pace.
You know, hearing you talk about this kind of game, it brings me back to a thought I've been having a lot lately, which is that I could really go for a new Rogue Squadron game.
Not Rogue Squadron, TIE Fighter. Come on.
No, more. I think more Rogue Squadron.
TIE Fighter versus Rogue Squadron is interesting, because TIE Fighter, obviously, you have that 360 box to work in, because it's almost all in space.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're very three-dimensional.
The problem I have with Rogue Squadron is that a lot of times it felt really, you know, you felt really just forced down.
It's at times it can feel a lot more like Star Fox.
Yeah.
Which I'm fine with, because I don't have any Star Fox games either.
Yeah, but so. I don't think it plays as well as Star Fox.
There were just times where it felt like, man, I wish I could just deviate off of this path and just go.
But I get you there. I get it.
Whereas TIE Fighter, it feels a lot slower, but mostly because you're dealing with big open spaces. Deus Combat games are sort of a weird hybrid, because you can move in three dimensions. Mm-hmm. You can push your jet up to the ceiling of whatever the jet you're operating in currently is. And you could stall and slam into the ground flying too low. It's all up to you. But it does make you fly all the way out there a lot of times.
Yeah.
Which, when you crash and have to start over, is really annoying. So you're flying, you know, at 1,300 miles an hour for 4 minutes to get to the destination. It's
Anyway, why don't we move on to Guillaume's new business?
Sure. Well, on episode, what was it, 356, I talked a little bit about Secret of Mana, and I was, you know, I was complaining that the game perhaps was not exactly what I was expecting. I grew up with the first Seiken Densetsu game, the prequel to Secret of Mana, which is Final Fantasy Adventure on the Game Boy. And I think Johnny made, you know, at some point said, oh, because I was raving so much about the game, Johnny was just, oh, I think I know what you're getting for Christmas. And I was like, what? What? No, that makes no sense. But because I had been, you know, because I had been playing Secret of Mana with the girlfriend and I mentioned her on the podcast, she decided to listen to that part of the podcast. And so that, yeah, so I got for Christmas Final Fantasy Adventure, which was a pretty awesome surprise. And I hadn't played that game in over a decade. It's been so long. But that game I must have played probably like a dozen times. You know, just like...
You got a physical copy of the game.
I did.
Does the battery still work?
It does.
Whoa.
I know. Like, it's really weird. I don't know. Someone must have replaced it.
Yeah, it's a pain in the ass to replace those batteries, too.
Right. So I was just like, wow, this is amazing. Like, it was an awesome surprise. So I started playing it right away. I had this Super Nintendo that I bought off a friend and that I had never plugged in. You know, I just liked the idea of owning a Super Nintendo again. So I plugged it in. I had a Super Game Boy that I must have purchased at some flea market. And I was, you know, I was pretty proud of my impulse purchase this past week. And so I played this on the big TV. And it actually looks pretty decent. I think, you know, like, perhaps it's because with a Game Boy, you don't expect to not see huge, disgusting pixels. But it looked better than I anticipated. Even plugged in with, like, the RF connector. Which I was sure, like, wow, I'm not going to be able to tolerate this. But it looks pretty amazing. But yeah, so I, you know, I played for a couple of hours and it's basically exactly as awesome as I remembered. I went straight back into it, but I think that there's a lot of, things that, you know, like I grew to accept about this game that, you know, like that there's a lot of flaws that I learned to cope with. And that I don't have to cope with again because I know what to expect. And I think that a person first time going through it would probably think, like, what the hell is this game? This is so poorly made. You know,
that's exactly how I feel about Mylan's Secret Castle. And it's why people who have played it and never clicked for them or they never really learned how to play it, they think I'm crazy for liking that game because it's
so obtuse. No, you are actually crazy for liking
it. Yeah. No, it's a very cool game, but it's extremely obtuse. And, you know, I went through a lot of struggles when I first got that game and I was a kid, but over time I played it for so much over so many years, I learned all the weird tricks and now I can play it really well because I know where the secrets are, basically. And if you don't know that stuff, that game makes no sense and is impossible.
Yeah. And I had...
Oh, yeah, it totally is. And it makes no effort to teach you those things either.
And I had more trouble than most kids would have, I think, with the game. Because I played this before I played even a Zelda game. And I played this before I had a really, you know, a better grasp of the English language. So the game was telling me things in a very poor English that I could not understand, but that I'm sure someone with a better grasp of the language would be able to decipher despite typos and bad syntax. And I just, you know, like just through sheer stubbornness, I made my way through the game and I found out exactly, you know, what walls I could break down and things like that. So, yeah, like there's a lot of things that really don't make sense in terms of design, or it's very archaic in terms of design. You've got consumable items that you need to progress through the game. Like you can buy keys at shops and you get a set of four and you use up one at each door that you open. And once you run out of keys in your inventory, which has limited space, then you're kind of boned, you know.
Sounds like Dragon Quest.
Yeah. There are like the enemies. There are enemies that you can kill, and they may give you that type of item that you need, but, you know, like it's really, it would have been better if these items that are needed to progress would have been, you know, like not consumables. It just makes sense. But I guess back then they didn't know better. The game is very...
Oh, they did. They just didn't care.
The game is very similar to Zelda in looks and kind of in the way that the combat works in some ways, but the structure is completely different. It's very, very linear. There's a lot of story. There's a lot of plot twists. There's a lot of, like, a big cast of characters. You've got NPCs that follow you around, and then they betray you or they get kidnapped. Then you go try to rescue them, and you fail, and you... There's a lot of stuff going on, and it's pretty much linear. And eventually the map opens up once you get a certain item, I guess, that allows you to go anywhere, to walk on water, basically. But it's not, you know, like that's pretty late in the game. And it's pretty cool. The game has a lot more, like I had forgotten about this, but the game has a lot of Final Fantasy DNA. And... You know, because I think I got confused with the fact that the Final Fantasy Legend games had nothing to do with Final Fantasy. And I was like, well, like, this isn't right. Like, this does certainly have something to do with Final Fantasy. Like, here's the Black Mage, here's the White Mage. My character looks like the Warrior class from the first Final Fantasy game. There's Chocobos, there's Moogles. This is definitely Final Fantasy. And then I looked it up, and yeah, like... The game is called Seiken Densetsu in Japan, but there is a subtitled Final Fantasy Gaiden. So originally this series was very much an offshoot of Final Fantasy. And then when the Super Nintendo game came out, Secret of Mana, they completely got rid of that and they made it more its own thing. And then when Final Fantasy Adventure got remade into Sword of Mana on the GBA, they got rid, actually, of the Final Fantasy elements that were in the game, and they replaced them with elements that were from more typical of the Mana series. So, yeah, it's really interesting. Like, you get these characters, the NPCs look very much like the Red Mage and character designs that you know from Final Fantasy. But then you look at the enemies and it's straight up Mana, you know, like it's straight up giant Ornuts and the Rabbites and the all these enemies that are very, very familiar to anyone who's played Secret of Mana. So it's pretty weird. It's pretty cool. I love it.
I would love to play this. I've said it before. I just say it again. Jeez, put this on Virtual Console.
I know.
Why isn't this stuff on there? I mean,
I would say okay. Square Enix has stuff to put on there first that would be even bigger sellers that they're not putting on there either.
Yeah, I know. I mean, just put anything on there.
They are incomprehensibly unwilling. Well, no, because they're trying to sell packages in the future, probably.
I don't know if they've put Seiken Densetsu yet, but Saga 2 and 3 and 1 have come out on the Japanese eShop already, like a couple of weeks ago. So maybe it's coming.
Okay, yeah, that's actually a really good sign.
Then again, maybe it's not.
Because I'd like to play those two as well.
Yeah,
those are the Final Fantasy Legend games in America, but I never really played those either, so I'd be down for it. Well, let's see. We've had a very retro-heavy new business here, so why don't I wrap things up with... a newer game, a very new game, a very modern game, and it won't take that long to talk about. It doesn't take that long to play through. It's called Tearaway. So it's the Vita game, of course, from Sony. You probably have heard a lot that it takes advantage of all the different weird gimmicky features that are on Vita, and it does so in a really nice, really actually interesting and fun way. And I would agree with that, but, you know, it is primarily a 3D platformer. And I think it's a game that demos extremely well. In fact, the Tearaway demo was probably my favorite demo from E3 of anything that I played, this past year in 2013. And that's largely why I was interested in it. It just made such a good impression, and coming from a team that I really, you know, I don't like Little Big Planet that much. So I was surprised that I enjoyed this as much. And I thought it was very, very smart about how it dealt with your expectations from a game by the Little Big Planet team, because it's very similar in some ways and it's extremely different in other ways. And I thought the differences were great. So, I did download this when it first came out. I paid full price for it. If I'd waited about 2 weeks, I probably could have gotten it for half, but, I was excited for it.
That's not a great thing to hear.
Yeah, you know, I didn't even actually start playing it until it had already come down in price, but you know, that's the curse. But you know,
it's been out that long, has it?
No, like 2 or 3 months. It came out the same day as Mario and Zelda, so November.
Oh, late November. So 1 month.
Yeah. Yeah, that's
not good.
But also because it's a smaller game and it was released right before the end of the year, it got rolled into all those clearance sales and everything that people were doing
anyway. That's true. So, all right, that's true.
Yeah. But it's a weird time of year to release that game. I mean, if they knew that it was going to get discounted that heavily, I would have appreciated if they just sold it for a lower price in the beginning, because I feel like I got a little bit suckered. But I still did enjoy the game. I mean, I don't know that it's $40 worth, but that's irrelevant because no one who hears this is going to go out and even find a copy for $40, except maybe on the Sony's version of the eShop. But a physical copy, geez, you shouldn't pay more than $20. But you know, Tearaway is actually a very, very good game. It's incredibly charming, and it really feels like I think the people at Media Molecule in Great Britain have really pulled off what Nintendo's been sort of teasing with the Paper Mario franchise for now over a decade. The idea that the world could be made of paper and that informs how things move, how things are made, what they look like, how things are positioned relative to each other. Sticker Star on the 3DS got the closest for me in making it really do feel like the world really does feel like it's constructed of things. And I think the stickers help too, because they really fit in very well into the theme. So I'm totally down with that conceptually, but I think when you play Tearaway, you have to look back at Paper Mario and say they weren't even close. Tearaway has such a more consistent, fully thought out, very deep aesthetic that it is so carefully done and so lovingly and charmingly done that I think it's a real achievement in visual design. And the music also is actually quite wonderful and very odd. The story I don't care for a whole lot, but it doesn't matter that much, I guess. It's a lot of kind of very thinly veiled excuses for them to use the front camera or the back touchscreen or something like that. It's neat, but you know, it's not going to make anybody break down in tears at the end of it. And I don't think it's supposed to, but I just loved being in this world, even when I didn't enjoy playing it as much. I think as a 3D platformer, the controls work very well. The camera's fine. It's just a little dull. It's just the things that you're doing a lot of times. You're collecting things or you're talking to all these little characters, and there's not a whole lot of challenge in the game until maybe towards the very, very end. And for a big chunk of the middle of Tearaway, they spend way too much focus on this combat mechanic that they've got set up, which is just terrible. It's just not fun to do. It's very slow. It never feels right. It never feels like something you want to do more of. And the story involves you doing more and more and more and more of it until finally you don't have to do it at all anymore. So that's nice. At the very end, it kind of goes like Half-Life 2, and it's like, hey, all these enemies that have been annoying you for so long, now they're just super easy, and the rest of the game is just all going to be platforming and weird world building, which is what the game excels at. So it does come back around. I think it starts off incredibly well, which was the demo that I'd played back at E3. I think it ends very well. There's some stuff in the middle I don't care for as much, but the whole thing is, you know, 4 hours long or something. So it's definitely worth blasting through if you have a Vita. Very lovely little game. Doesn't quite live up to the expectations and the hopes that I had for it from the first time I played it, but I'm still very glad that I played it. Well, that I think needs to wrap up new business, so we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got your listener mail.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a feature. Staff says, what game do you hope will make your 2014 complete? By Josh Max. Some of the NWR staff give their thoughts on what games will fill the video game shaped hole in their heart in the new year. None of them say X or Leighton versus Wright, so they can be ignored. JP Corbin said a soccer game, so please shun him appropriately. There's poor JP. There's also an import review for Gaia Breaker on Wii U by Don Koopman. the very first eShop game using Nintendo's HTML5/JavaScript toolkit has reached the Japanese eShop, and it's a shoot 'em up. Turns out it's a shoot 'em up with awful controls. Ever want to play a shoot 'em up with a touchscreen? Or what about shooting by having to hammer the D-pad of all things to fire each individual shot? No. So I guess we continue to wait for the first good HTML5/JavaScript eShop game.
Aww.
It's first. It's a first. It's noteworthy for that in and of itself. We have our end of the year feature, NWR staff's favorite 10 games of 2013. During my last stint as features editor, we ditched the quote game of the year moniker, as producing the final winner segment made people quit, caused long simmering disputes, created allegations of ballot stuffing, and was utterly detestable. Didn't we have some great games this year? I love video games. You probably love video games too. So look, here's some 10 really good games.
All of the things James said about that process are true.
But we don't. That's why we don't name a game of the year anymore. It's just too hard. So we say here are 10 really good games, and we go through the horse trading process to come up with the list.
No, it made for like actual real serious drama that we don't need.
Yep. So instead, we just sit down as a staff, we discuss it, and we trade votes to get 10 games. It's like running a political convention now.
Yep, just like on Giant Bomb, they do the same thing.
And finally, we have a feature, Nintendo World's Report Year in Review. December is that end for 10, and we just finished December. So it's time for Nintendo World Report to review the news and events of the 10 months of 2013.
To be fair, probably were 2 months where they didn't release a game.
That's so true. Yeah. That was for my language off. Major homies.
Latin. All right. Well, go learn more about Latin and Nintendo and other video games over at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. It's time for Listener Mail, the first batch of 2014. The address, as always, is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And the first email this week, one of my favorites that we've gotten in a long time, comes from Klex Yoshi, who writes, I'd like to take a moment and talk about Jason Ricci and New Blood, whose bumpers, the music, offer Radio Free Nintendo a very chill feel to them, particularly the piece you've been using since before Greg left the show. For some reason, it makes me imagine the crew recording from within the bowels of a smoky tavern that's covered in various sports memorabilia and way too many taxidermied animals and animal limbs on display, all with the tankards of a fine wheat-based lager. That, or possibly you guys sitting in some of the stores in that village in the beginning of Castlevania Dawn of Sorrow, minus maybe the various curry-tossing skeletons and satanic cult-controlled castle sitting over the hill. Regardless. Yeah, wow. That was labored. Regardless, New Blood's harmonica-infused blues rock thing gives Radio Free Nintendo a much-needed flavor, but one that you have to stretch to associate with video games. My question is as follows. If you folks had the proper license to use a song from a video game, which hasn't stopped you from using that Kirby's Epic Yarn piece for Now Playing, since you got bored of the awesomeness that is Puzzle Plank Galaxy, and had the money to commission Jason Ricci to do a cover of said song for a new RFN theme, which song would you esteemed folk on the panel choose to bump the show?
Oh my god.
Is there any video game music piece that you would love to have rearranged for the band that plays us in and out and through the break?
For nose harmonicas?
We haven't used that one in years. It's a nose flute, by the
Excuse
way.
Excuse me, a nose... lest I denigrate the humble art of nose instruments.
Yeah, there used to be a few seconds clip of a nose flute on RFN.
There did. I remember editing it in there going, what the fuck is he playing?
Yeah. So, by the way, the song that Klex Yoshi is referring to that opens, it actually is the only song we use. The last time we went to season 3.0 or whatever we called it, I had the idea to use this really long instrumental track from Jason's last album and use different parts of it for the different parts of the show and to kind of give it that more unified theme musical theme for the entire show. And I think it worked out pretty well. The song may not be to everyone's liking, but it's one of my favorites from that album. And I think it's grown on a lot of people. But that song is called Afro Blue. And it is really kind of, it's a Caribbean jazz song. So it has kind of a pirate feel to it. So, you know, when this email was describing like sitting in a smoky bar and having tankards of beer, I thought, you know, that's probably not that far off from the images that that Mongo Santamaria had in his head when he was writing that stuff. But anyway, I think my answer to this question, just one of my favorite video game songs of all time, is the Megas theme from Chrono Trigger. And I think it would sound really cool with this band, which unfortunately the band itself doesn't exist anymore, but Jason's still around and he still plays. I would love to hear him play a version of that Megas theme song with, it starts with the kind of high pitched whistle and then later it brings in this big kind of booming organ. It's like a synthesizer, but it sounds kind of like an organ. I think that piece, that part would translate really well to harmonica. A lot of the rest of it is sort of this booming classical, but I think you could do an arrangement for a rock band that would sound really good. So that'd be my pick.
It's a tough question. I don't feel like I know enough about music to really know what would sound good as blues. I especially don't know blues all that well.
Well, just say rock and roll. I mean, just, you know, if you could hear one of your favorite rock bands play a video game song like unexpectedly in the middle of their show, which I've heard before, especially Zelda theme comes up a lot. What would really, you know, what would be like your ideal rock arrangement of a video game song?
Say Tetris theme. Say it. Tetris that's theme probably, for nose blues. Make it happen.
I think that's been done before too.
Well, I think one of the best ending songs in a Mario game is the one from Super Mario World, where you got the parade of enemies and all that jazz. And I don't know if you guys recall what it sounds like, but it could sound good on an harmonica, I guess. I got nothing.
Well, by the way, if you are more of a big band person, there's a big band, there's a CD in Japan of big band remixes of Mario music, and it's fantastic.
You're also probably 70 and don't listen to the show.
No, but it's awesome. I mean, remember, it was a big fad in the 90s with you know, all the ska bands getting popular for a couple years, and so I think that stuff, there's still plenty of people who are familiar with it and like it. That's really good.
For me, unfortunately, it's already been remixed a million different ways. A lot of the Ace Attorney music works really well as sort of jazz or blues or kind of style music. In fact, they did a whole album of that stuff. But some of the Leighton music would actually work pretty well on a small piece of, you know, sort of a blues infused guitar. So, you know, kind of a low, gritty sound to it, sort of providing the rhythm line, and then probably a single or double reeded instrument sort of providing the melody.
That's interesting, because that music always sounds like it's being played by like a trio in a French cafe.
Oh, it totally
on the
is.
Street.
It's a French accordion trio. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
I used to remember what type of music that was. I can't remember the name.
You can certainly play that music on harmonica. The accordion and harmonica are very similar instruments, and they have a lot of overlap in tone.
Yep.
But I guess I'm not really seeing how that translates into a rock
imagine
band.
Imagine that if you're going to do it sort of with sort of the kind of guttural guitar, I would almost want something that has kind of a reed sound to it to sort of give the sharp contrast. I think you need some kind of light percussion line to go with it, but I think you could do a three-piece pretty well. It would very much change the vibe of that song, but it would still sort of be different period, but regionally consistent with the Paris music scene of a different era versus the music scene that Leighton tries to convey.
Now, when he said that it gave the show a much needed flavor, I thought that we brought the flavor.
No, we bring the bland chicken.
Yeah, we need the music. Otherwise, this show would have no personality
RFN,
whatsoever.
Your source for the boiled chicken broth of Nintendo News.
But I think it's funny that they mention Castlevania, because that series, of course, is renowned for its very rock-influenced soundtrack. And, of course, there's a lot of really great like heavy metal and hard rock rearrangements of Castlevania music, again, especially in Japan. But I used to have a CD of this. I think our old friend Dave Trammell from the Planet GameCube staff, who might have been on this show like once a long, long time ago. But I remember he burned a bunch of Castlevania rock CDs for the E3 gang, like back in 2001 or 2002, probably. And I had them in my car for years. And sometimes when, you know, I had run out of things to listen to, and I was like kind of digging around in the console or the dashboard, and I would find that CD and I'd slip it in there and be like, man, this really works. This Castlevania music, like, it translates just perfectly. Cause that's kind of what it is in the first place.
Right. Know? It's arranged for the Super Nintendo music chip, which didn't handle kind of rock sound that well.
Super Nintendo did a lot more than the NES one.
That's true.
It was, I'd say, almost impossible to do like, you know, really legitimate sounding rock music on NES.
Oh, I mean, yeah.
With Super Nintendo, you could get a hell of a lot closer to
it. Because I mean, part of rock music is sort of this depth of sound. You know, you need lots of parts going, but the NES can only do what, 4-channel?
Mm-hmm.
So you devoted at least 1-channel to sound effects.
Well, and it didn't have any kind of good guitar sampling.
No.
Just the MIDI instrument for that stuff was not up to snuff on NES. And some games in Japan came with like special chips built in to help them sound better. But, you know, there's only so much you could do on NES. But
did,
on Super
didn't
Nintendo,
the disc drive have more sound capacity as well?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I think it had 2 extra channels, but yeah. I don't think it added any new instruments. So you could have more lush music, but it would still sound like NES music.
Right.
Castlevania 3 did that, actually, just to come back to that series.
Yep, which means the U.S. version of that doesn't sound as good.
Yeah, that's right, which is really sad. And that's the one they keep giving us on Virtual Console. So there's our little, you know, 50 hertz sob story, you know.
Bringing it back around. Close the circle.
Yeah. Anyway, fun question. Thank you, Clex Yoshi. Just for anyone wondering, I've been thinking about putting new music on the show for a while, since we have been using this one for a long time. I kind of was hoping we'd get it by the first of the year, but I ran into some obstacles with that. So I'm hoping within maybe 2 or 3 weeks, we're going to find some new clips for you and do something a little bit different. And I'm hesitant to do it always, just because I think the music really does kind of gives the show a signature. Even if it's somewhat subliminal, from when you listen to a lot of episodes, I think it helps you kind of get in the right mood as a kind of way to, oh yeah, it puts you right back in the right headspace. Cause you start to associate it with whatever, you know, sort of mental state you're in when you listen to podcasts, whatever you're doing.
Do we want to open it up to the audience then?
Yeah.
If they want to go like, no, don't do it. Then all right, whatever.
Oh, no, I thought you meant open this question about...
Oh, yeah. Oh, we absolutely can open the question up to the audience.
No, in terms of changing the music, I mean, I definitely want to do it.
You get no say.
I definitely want to do it. If anyone has, like, a really great suggestion or a really great idea for what would be a good new theme song for the podcast, I'd be happy to take it. I'm looking at some more stuff from Jason Ricci's catalog we haven't used before, just because, you know, I do have his permission. He has a pretty big library of songs, that we've never used before. And I just really like him. And there's a lot to be said for just the consistency of using the same person's music over and over. But I'm also, you know, I'm definitely willing to entertain other ideas. So, especially if we have, you know, some kind of legal standing to use that music, I would prefer. But, if you have, you know, really great ideas, please send them in.
Or if you have a nose flute, send that in. But clean your nose.
Yeah, yeah.
Clean your nose flute.
I mean, don't
people.
Send me your used nose flute.
Clean your nose flutes, people.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Don't send ocarinas either. So, James is going to read the next email for
us. Oh, no, I need to put my reading glasses on.
Yep.
I don't even wear reading glasses.
You're getting old.
Tim, a.k.a. Smeatbass, writes, I've been in marketing for 16 years. It's obvious that the first and foremost thing you need and want to do is sell your product at all costs. How you approach it is what will either make or break a product. In summary, I say that these struggles began in 2005. The struggles, we're talking about the Wii U, by the way, in case anybody's
Yeah, sorry. I cut out a lot of context for this.
Got to give some context to the storm.
It's still a long email, even after I trimmed it up a lot. Yep. So.
In summary, I say that these struggles began in 2005 when they, Nintendo, were so wallowed in their own success, they didn't see that the rest of the gaming world was going to move on and not stick around. Gamers have short attention spans. The first thing they, again, Nintendo, need to do, obviously, is not miss E3 again. That was such a stupid mistake that cost them dearly. More importantly, they need to get the name buzzing again. The thing they need to do and have done before is regroup and realize that once they have crafted a cohesive, clear message on their system, they need to do whatever they always did, and that's not follow polls and trends, but create them. Nintendo are masters at it. Any major company is. I've sat in marketing meetings where the first thing said is, quote, "We are going to rename our product to this, and people will follow it because we will make them believe that this is what they want." That's the mindset of marketing. It's the basic marketing 101. Make the people believe they want something even if they don't. That's what Reggie was so good at 10 years ago, and that's what they need to do again. Obviously, they need games, but they also need a vision. Smash Bros. Will be great, so will Mario Kart, but unless they say with certainty to the consumer that this is absolutely the next evolution or revolution to the game that sold 25 million copies on our last system, it won't work. I believe the system can be saved if they take advantage of opportunities to regather that image. Will they do it? I don't know, but that's how I see it, and that's how marketing works. I'm not in charge of a multi-billion dollar company like Iwata-san is, but I've been in marketing for my entire adult life and know that you can't coast on nostalgia forever. You have to make yourself wanted.
Hear, hear.
In summary.
Yeah, and like I said, that's about maybe half of Tim's email that he sent to us, and I wish I could read it all, but I don't have enough breath. So
it's my breath you were using.
I thought it was a super interesting email, and you know, it's very informative, and you know, it has a perspective that we don't hear very much. I mean, marketing is one of those buzzwords that every armchair quarterback absolutely adores, and or especially armchair CEO, I guess. And you know, I think it's nice to hear from someone who actually does that professionally and knows what really goes into it, what it can do and what it can't do. And I really appreciate the perspective here. And I think, I mean, it all sounds very logical to me, you know, in terms of his prescriptions. Like, they need to go back and create a new identity for this thing. And they can do it. I mean, Microsoft did it with the 360. After Twice. Kinect came out, they pretty much.
I mean, they reinvented two separate times.
Yeah, but I don't just mean the firmware update. Now,
that as this is the serious gamers gaming machine. And then they cast it as, this is a multimedia device that will run everything in your home. And they said, this is the Kinect Fun Box!
Right.
Yeah. I mean, they didn't just change the hardware in place, which in and of itself was impressive and speaks volumes to their capabilities as a technology company.
I agree.
They changed the perception around the device, which to do that, they basically changed the wheels on the car while it was going around the track.
But Microsoft Twice. Also had kind of not only a coherent marketing strategy, but also they enforced rules that everyone had to follow. Like, okay, you're making a game for the 360. It has to be HD, whatever that means. And Nintendo's just isn't doing that, you know? Like, Nintendo...
Well,
Microsoft
went back on most of those.
I know, but initially they did, so they could say, well, our games are HD, right? Nintendo right now can't say, well, you can't play off the TV, because that's not, you know, I don't even know if most games can be played off the TV.
I would imagine probably most.
Well, they didn't want to tie anyone's hands, especially in the launch period where you want people to be experimental and to try crazy new things with this crazy new controller. They didn't want to preclude games that were so intertwined between the gamepad and the TV and the relationship between those that they didn't want to force people to have to kind of, you know, shoot lower than that and only because off TV play has some pullback. I mean, it has some trade-offs, right?
Sure, so. I understand that, but you know, that's kind of one of the reasons why it's so hard to explain what the gamepad does. It does many things for many games. So maybe it would have been better from a marketing standpoint to actually limit the things that developers can do with it.
I don't think you have to limit developers at all. I think you can still get at what you're leading towards, which is that you can create, you can now, after the fact, establish off-TV play as the defining feature. If that's the one Nintendo wants to pick, if they think that one has the most cachet among the general populace, they can go after that hardcore and say, look, that's what our box does that nobody else can really say. It's all in one box. It's one system, and you can play it both on the TV and off. And even if not every single game supports that, they can still make that the predominant identity, and they can market that.
Sure,
I don't know if that's the right feature to focus on, but I think the general strategy there is the way they should go. I mean, that's what Tim is saying, at least.
Right, but then in the UK, Nintendo of Europe actually got in hot water because of their marketing, because they showed that, yes, you can play off TV, and the ad didn't mention, well, it's just for some games. And so,
you have to keep in mind, when you're releasing stuff in the EU, you're going to have to cover your screen in disclaimers.
Yeah, just throw a disclaimer at the end. Easy.
Yeah, that was not understanding that the EU will fine you for literally anything they can manage.
Yeah, but I understand they can slap an asterisk there and say, well, not all games are compatible, but it does throw a wrench in the idea that you reshape your marketing, just like you focus on just the one feature that you want people to know about.
Well, I mean, you can still focus on the one feature and say, or you can really, you can avoid having to do the asterisk by saying the message in the right way. Instead of saying play things off screen with the gamepad, you say you would couch it by saying, you know, and most games can be played without any TV at all, right on the gamepad.
Yeah,
done.
That sounds cool to me.
All right.
Of course, in the EU, that's probably still not good enough, but you know. You manage. That's why you have. That's why you have to have local people running the marketing for a region. Because if you're making all your marketing decisions out of Kyoto, things are going to get screwed up.
Yeah. So Tim wrote in really with a very informational letter. It wasn't a huge discussion topic, or wasn't loaded with questions for us. But I think it was kind of a conversation starter, and
it dovetail nicely with what we were talking about when we saw those numbers a few weeks ago, where the thought was we had been hammering them for not spending money on marketing, but we sort of had backtracked and said, well, maybe they need to figure out what the hell they want to say first and then spend money on marketing. And I think Tim is telling us why that's important. I mean, there's a certain sense of, well, obviously you should know what you want to say before you spend money to say it, but he sort of clearly lays out why that impacts the consumer and how the consumer perceives the product.
I think there's a long history of companies doing this and doing it successfully. And even within video games, you know, not just Microsoft with the Xbox 360 and what they have.
Oh, yeah, like Nintendo with the Virtual Boy. No, I'm joking.
No, I was going to say Sony with the PS3. You remember when that system first came out, it was super expensive and it had tons of bizarre sort of hodgepodge features that didn't seem to really coalesce into anything, and it didn't have many games on it. People are like, I've got this box that like has way too much technology and not enough gaming.
It wasn't
focus.
Even that. It was that people weren't buying the box. Remember, there was that infamous incident where Sony's PR staff was like, no, you can't find PS3s.
Well, it was loaded up with so many technology initiatives that people initially had no use for whatsoever. You know, something like Blu-ray drive was just a very niche appeal when the PS3 first came out. Within 2 or 3 years, it was a fairly popular feature. It was something that you would like to have in your home that you may not already. And so I think what Sony did very smartly is after a couple of years, they were able to bring the price down finally into the $300 and $400 range. And then they went with this new marketing campaign called It Only Does Everything. And they used what was foreseen as almost a weakness up front, which is that the system had too many features and it was really overpriced. I don't know if this sounds familiar to anyone else, but it's very similar to a lot of the arguments that have been occurring around Wii U lately, which is that it almost has too much stuff. It doesn't know where to focus. It doesn't do anything well enough to really go after it. And it doesn't have enough games. And now that some of these things are starting to get better, there's more games on it, the price is coming down, some of the features that it has are improving. I think they can go back and say, look, we can create a new identity that actually really turns this stuff into a positive.
One of the things about the it only does everything strategy was it let them jettison things that didn't take. So you remember the it only does everything strategy originally when they first unveiled it, they unveiled it at E3. It was 2011, I think, because they covered all the halls with these banners that had the phrase on it and then demoed somebody using it. And the one they pushed really hard because it was coinciding with it was Move. And then later they just sort of walked away from Move and they're like, eh. But because they didn't tie up the marketing in that specific thing, that was one of many things that fell under the banner. They could sort of let that go without, you know, looking like they've jettisoned it into space.
Yeah.
They could clearly back away from the thing that wasn't working and sort of not have to save face in the process.
You know, oddly enough, with the Wii U being such a sales bomb right now, we haven't seen the December sales numbers yet, but
I think they were out.
I don't know, they're not out yet. Okay. It'll be a couple weeks. I'm not expecting anything miraculous out of it. They'll be improved, but not by any abnormal percentage. I expect that retailers are going to start, you know, trimming down even more their allocations for Wii U systems and for the games, the shelf space that they give to the games, because it's just clear that, you know, until something drastic happens, this stuff isn't going to sell anyway. And I think, oddly enough, this might be an interesting push for Nintendo to focus more on their digital business, which they've spent, I would imagine, a lot of money. They've certainly spent a lot of effort and attention among their fans for setting up this digital infrastructure. The eShops on both systems now are synchronized. They both work really well. They have very nice storefronts that are light years beyond what they've ever done before. And every single game that Nintendo releases, which is pretty much every game that you would want, especially on Wii U, is on that thing.
So and their profit margin is killer by comparison.
Exactly.
If you buy it
and this helps them stay afloat and prepare for whatever comes next. So if they really focused on the eShop and they marketed things that way, I think they could go very far. And, you know, when you look at things like the Apple TV and even like the Google Chromecast, people are now they're comfortable going out to a Best Buy and buying a device and then taking that home and then getting all their content through that thing from there on. In other words, cycle of going back over and over to a shop to buy more content is breaking. People don't want to go buy DVDs anymore. A lot of people, myself included, don't want to go out and buy video games at a store anymore. I'd much rather download it. And I don't think I'm a niche market anymore. I think a lot of people feel that way because everything else works like that. So if Nintendo could get behind that and say, look, with our new box, our Wii U console, every game that you want to play and they show the reel is right there on the internet. You never have to leave your house. I mean, that is really good for them. And like you could say that burns retail bridges, but so do, you know, shitty sales. So I don't think they have that much to lose. At least on the console side.
I think that whole business though, the retail, I mean, we don't necessarily know all the dark magic that takes place between retailers and console manufacturers, but I think they still need
there's some bad mojo. Look at Amazon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Yeah. They gotta manage that relationship at least to a certain extent.
Well, they've done a very poor job with Amazon, I would say. I still don't think you can buy Nintendo systems on Amazon.
I don't think you can buy them directly from Amazon, no.
Yeah. You have to go through one of their third party
people who are being fulfilled by Amazon, which is weird.
Yeah, but like if you had Amazon Prime, for instance, it wouldn't apply to most of those. So, they've got a real problem there that has been years now that they have been dealing with Amazon. And I think that's probably hurt them very negatively. I think we might have had an email recently or I saw some stuff on a forum. But some people are thinking like this might not be a trivia item for Nintendo. Like the issues with Amazon and not listing Nintendo products may be really serious. It may be like really, really hurting their bottom line. I could believe it because Amazon is a humongous retailer, you know, right. For a lot of people in the West, Amazon might be the only major store you really shop at anymore other than like going out for food, you know? So that's not good. Anyway.
I want my Wii U delivered by an air drone.
I want my Wii U delivered by men in business suits.
So, actually, this will be a good segue onto the third and final email this week, and Guillaume is going to read that one.
Christian, a.k.a. Tween20, writes, I know that you have discussed the issue of digital versus hard copy games before, but I was wondering if you could revisit it in light of recent developments. That is, if the Wii U lifespan is very limited, and Nintendo actually does release a new console, do you have any thoughts as to how I should position my Wii U library for optimal compatibility with the next generation? To cut costs, can Nintendo forgo hardware that allows compatibility of physical media in favor of just digital copies? Do you think digital copies will be transferable to a new system? The Wii U library may be small, but it does have some really good games that I would like to continue playing in the future. For instance, Pikmin 3, which I own a physical copy of, although I also have the DLC. I particularly ask now as the retailer's sales on physical video games are very enticing, but I don't want two systems hooked up on my TV to play them in the future. This is, I don't know, like the whole may be compatible with digital files but not physical media. Sure, that could happen in the way that PSP games that I bought on PSN are now compatible on the Vita if I decided to get one. Like, that would be cool. Somehow, like, I didn't plan for this, but my collection of PSP games is future-proof because, you know, I bought on PSN and not physical. So, but that was completely through chance because then you look at the PS3 and I bought everything on PSN again. And, well, even if I had the discs, I don't, but even if I had the discs, like, whatever, nothing is compatible on the PS4.
Right. I think the reason that it works out well for PSP Vita is because, I mean, they weren't going to be able to say, they'd already basically built a digital platform for the PSP. They did it with the PSP Go.
Mm-hmm.
And they built an incredibly moronic format for moving physical copies of games in the UMD disc. So I think it makes sense that they made it digitally compatible. And I think probably because the hardware is more iterative than the PS4 is to the PS3.
Yeah.
My guess is Nintendo's hardware, I mean, keep in mind, the Wii U is still an evolution of the GameCube hardware.
I think this is the end of the line for that architecture. I think if Nintendo makes another console, and I do believe they will, I expect it will be quite different. And I do not expect it would be backwards compatible, especially when you consider that they're probably not going to go with a gamepad again. So, and they would, I would bet at that point, the need to support all these damn Wii remotes and balance boards and shit like that is going to become very burdensome, for a new system. And they would rather not
every game you
deal
make
with all those interfaces.
You have to decide, all right, does this game need to support all this hardware? What hardware does it have to support?
Mm-hmm.
But then you have to go test all that crap.
It's a lot easier on handhelds because they're self-contained. There aren't really any accessories for handheld systems that are required to play games. So in the case of, you know, Vita and PSP, that's a pretty direct transfer. Nintendo's been doing it on handheld systems for a long time. And I do think whatever comes out after 3DS, and there certainly will be another Nintendo handheld after 3DS, it will play 3DS games. I think they have committed to maintaining, you know, one generation backwards compatibility. I think their customer base very fully expects that, and they really appreciate it, and they really use it because they do cater to a younger fan base and people who are more budget conscious. So,
but I think it will support it both physically and not physically. Because here's the thing, I don't see Nintendo just completely balling out of the retail video games, especially for the handhelds.
Oh no, I agree with that. Yeah, but
so
I think there is an expense
in,
you know, having the slot itself be physically compatible, or including one whereas you might not even need that slot for new stuff. And you saw this with like the GBA cartridge slot on the DS and the DS Lite, but then eventually with the DSi they got rid of it. Because that stuff, it costs money to continue to make and support that interface, and it makes the system architecture more complicated. So they would rather would drop that stuff eventually.
Or my guess though is they'd probably just find a way to reuse that same sort of port architecture, because ultimately, it's just an SD card effectively.
Yeah, and at some point you've got to imagine they started thinking we should future-proof this so we don't have to
have been the DS is where they did it, because ultimately it's the same sort of reader. They may have been really clever 10 years ago, and they're just running it through.
Yep. So, yeah, I agree on the handheld front. You've got nothing to worry about, either physical or digital. I think you'll be okay.
My guess on the software front is they will support the gamepad on the next one. I think they've just made too much of an investment on it.
Hmm.
I wouldn't be shocked if they didn't, but I think they probably will. And I think ultimately it won't matter if you buy your games digital or not digital, digital or physical. It'll be compatible one way or it won't be compatible at all.
Well, again, if they want to support Wii U games on the next console, they also have to support a lot of Wii hardware.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying.
I'm not sure about that. I think the Wii stuff has been around already. I think it is seen, rightly so, as a burden for Wii U.
The fact that it has so many controllers. Just the controllers. I mean, like I said, I think ultimately what you're looking at is it's an all or nothing prospect mm-hmm. how I'm looking at it.
I'm on the console side, I think nothing. I think they've done all for a long time. You know, they had a hard break between N64 and GameCube.
Right.
But then after that, it's been very consistent. There's always an overlap in backwards compatibility.
None of their systems were backwards compatible before Wii.
None of their consoles, right. That was the start of it. Yeah. Well, because at that point they had moved to discs, and it's easier to, you know, physically it's easier to go backwards compatible with discs than
and
cartridge.
That's why I think it'll be an all or nothing prospect, because ultimately their next console, if it has physical software, will be a disc. So it won't be a reader issue. It'll just be, is the hardware there that supports this thing?
Mm.
Do we think that there's going to be a Wii channel in the next?
A Wii U channel? A Wii channel?
Yeah, well, actually a Wii channel, because I'm kind of wondering what will happen to all my VC collection, you know?
I don't know.
I think there will be a Wii channel that will take you to a part of the new eShop where you can download Wii games by paying $20 a piece for them. I don't think it'll play your old Wii games.
Hmm.
I still don't understand why we haven't seen Wii Virtual Console games yet.
Why don't we have N64 or GameCube, James? Because they're crazy. I mean,
yeah. Why don't we have DS games that can download for? Except we do have DS games you can download on the 3DS eShop, but they're not called DS games. They're the same game repackaged.
Yeah,
it's nuts. It's bonkers.
Yeah, I don't understand who's running the virtual console house at Nintendo. It seems like nobody.
But it's on just fire right now.
It doesn't exist. It's crazy. I mean, like, there's one game every other week, and it's just the most random bullshit game. What are they thinking? I mean,
suggesting that the virtual console house is slow motion, the fall of the house of Usher?
It's just, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's good reference.
there you go.
I think, you know, I don't know that virtual console is the key to, you know, financial success for Nintendo. I don't know really how lucrative it is. It seems like probably a small market
but
that
it probably
follows
makes some money.
It at least makes your fans happy, and you guys could do a lot with that right
well,
now.
I mean,
you guys are really lacking in that area with some of your most ardent fans. And I think, you know, releasing a whole bunch of virtual console games, at least to break even on that stuff, you've come out ahead, because at least you've made people happy. You've kept people from like trading in their Wii U's because they want to keep it around so they can keep playing these new releases.
It just seems like they should be able, I mean, the Wii U and the 3DS can already play Wii and DS games respectively, mm-hmm. natively. And the Wii U and 3DS can already play essentially disc copies of Wii U and 3DS games when they're installed to the system.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like the jump shouldn't be that hard.
No. On the 3DS side, there is some light at the end of the tunnel, right? Because recently, as a platinum reward for Club Nintendo in Japan, Nintendo has released Advance Wars Days of Ruin, a DS game, and gave it to their Club Nintendo members.
How did they package it?
It looks like one of the GBA games, I think, on the menu. I'm not sure. Like, I've only seen, like, a picture.
I'm curious if they reworked the game into, like, an eShop download, or if it's just a straight-up port of or straight-up eShop version of the ROM.
Yeah.
Hmm.
A virtual console version. That would be – that's a very – because if they've done that, if they've built some kind of booter quasi-emulator thing that lets them run DS games, that's really cool.
By the way, can we please get that reward? I would love – I mean, oh, yeah. Man, that would be so
would
much better
just,
than
– I would get it just
freaking Majora's Mask soundtrack CD that I'll never play.
I would get it just to play with to see if it's a ROM or not. I mean,
I would just love to play that game. I never played it. I don't think that game even came out in Japan to begin with. So that must be the kind of gimmick behind this Club Nintendo reward over there, is that this is the only way you can play this game in Japan, right?
It's on the eShop, but they won't sell it. It's only as a Club Nintendo Platinum reward.
That's just dumb. Like,
what is the logic behind that?
Why would they make it special for their, you know, their craziest fans? But
they're trying to make it's like Reggie sending you $50 pizza gift card.
Yeah, I didn't get one of those.
I didn't get one either. I want a Bigfoot pizza, you asshole.
Reggie, I thought we were friends.
Anyway, like this came out, like the news came out like in October, and I haven't really seen any more details since then about this release. So
to me, I mean, there's a lot of stuff they can do right now that will get, I think, guides you towards what their plans for backwards compatibility is. Whatever the next piece of hardware is, whatever it is, it's going to have the processor capacity to emulate things like Wii and GameCube games.
You think?
You maybe not, but Wii and GameCube. So I would think that definitely those are out. I would say those are all going to be download only stuff. But maybe Wii U. But if it's backwards compatible, like I said, it's going to be backwards compatible both ways instead of just one.
Wouldn't it be great on the new console if you had to go into Wii U mode and then on that menu select Wii mode? It'd be like Inception. You're just going layers and layers and layers deeper until you finally...
Well, Johnny, to be fair, Nintendo would totally do that. that is absolutely them.
Yeah, I think that would be how they would go forward with it. I'd love to see that. I mean, I would hate to use it, but it would be hilarious.
It would be like our trolling come true.
So is the answer that we don't know?
The answer is we don't know.
Of course.
I mean, I would almost say, and people are gonna hiss and say I don't know what I'm talking about. I would almost say that if it's not gonna be backwards compatible one way, it's gonna be the download software. I still don't trust Nintendo not to screw that up.
Nah, but here's what I'll say. I mean, maybe this is what you're saying, James. I'm not sure I completely followed your argument, but I think either the new system will play both digital and hard copy games, or it won't do either one. So right. It doesn't really matter what format you pick for right now. I think that's the takeaway here. Go ahead and get whatever's cheapest or whatever.
My comment there was I just don't trust them to get accounts right.
This point, I think they've gone too far down that path to not see it through.
We've said that
famous
before,
last words, but yeah.
Said that before and been wrong.
They really have done a nice job of iterating on their, you know, their infrastructure and doing a lot better on that. So I think they're on the right path. I don't think they'll ever give us, you know, full cross-buy, and it may very well be like this virtual console crap on Wii U where you have to pay a surcharge to upgrade it if you own it on the previous system.
And that I could see.
I could see them doing that. You know, I mean, you know, but it's a new hardware generation. So like in a sense, I think I think Sony comes across as being extremely generous when they do things like, oh, you bought Flower 5 years ago on PS3, you get the PS4 version for free, even though it's not emulated whatsoever. It's a completely unique version with new features, brand new, beautiful, 60 frames per second. I think they come across as being like really heroic for giving that kind of thing away, and they build up good word of mouth. Nintendo's going to look at that and say, we'd rather charge you $3. Maybe you get a discount if you have the old version. But
Sony's runs their digital shop like an everything must go anyway.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They're crazy Eddie. Yeah, they were just giving away.
There are times where I look at what they're doing on PSN Plus and go, I don't want any of these games, which is why I don't have Plus. But what the fuck are you doing?
Let me say, I would be a lot more okay paying Nintendo $1 or $1.50 to upgrade games if they were actually releasing the games on Wii U that I want to play, and a lot of them. You know, like I would very quickly max out my credit card on $1.50 upgrade fees on Wii U if they were actually going crazy and updating all this stuff and putting out the WiiWare games too, so I wouldn't have to deal with that bullshit.
Did you hear that? Iwata bankrupt Jonathan Metz.
That's right. Do it to me. But my biggest problem with it is just the poor release schedule. You know, the surcharge I find annoying, but at the same time, it's like, it's a dollar. I don't care that much. It's a dollar. You know, if it's a game that I love, I will happily pay a dollar. I'll gripe about it, but I'll still pay it. But my problem is they don't even give me the games to pay a dollar for. So That's ultimately my big problem, but I could definitely see them doing some kind of upgrade surcharge in the future. You say, hey, you can play your Wii U games that you downloaded from the eShop on the new system. Just pay us $5. You know, Sony tried to do this. They actually, in Japan, they did it with, was it PSP Go or Vita, where you mailed in your UMDs and you paid?
Yes.
It was this crazy ass thing. Or they...
I think it was PSP Go.
Yeah,
I mean, the PSP Go was just a hybrid of terrible ideas.
Well, yeah, the whole thing was just very convoluted, but they did try it. I think in America, they just decided not to bother with it. But, you know, I could totally see Nintendo going, that would be the bad path. But in that path, you
that
still
would
get
be
to upgrade.
Ridiculous path.
You still get to upgrade. I mean, it makes it a harder decision if you have to pay.
Send us your disc copies of all your Wii U games, and we'll send you some download codes. There's a warehouse where they're just crushing Wii U games with a forklift.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
They're burning money because of inflation.
If you're listening somewhere, don't do that. That was a joke.
Hold on to your precious discs. All right. Well, that is quite enough, listener mail, for this week. I think we got into some weird territory, but thank you, everyone, for writing in. I thought they were super, super interesting questions this week, as we pretty much always have. Again, the address for your email to the show is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And as we close out the show here, I wanted to remind everyone that we are still getting ready for Retroactive. You're going to hear me talk about it every week until we actually do it. So we're going to be playing F-Zero X for N64 and F-Zero GX for GameCube.
Game is fast. I had forgotten.
Yeah,
it's so fast.
Oh, it's too fast for GNOMS.
Yikes. Yeah, we're going to be talking F-Zero. Greg will come back for it. It'll be a live show. We'll have call-ins. We'll make sure John is around that week. We haven't scheduled it yet, but again, probably towards the end of this month. So the time is coming very soon. Please pick up those games if you have not already. I know I brought my N64 back from Alabama, so I'm getting ready too. Also just wanted to say once again that we are hoping next week to do our top fives of 2013. If you have a top five that you'd like to share of Nintendo games that came out last year, please send those in to the email address, we'll definitely consider those. But I'm hoping next week John will be back and we can focus on that. We'll take up a whole segment on it. It's always one of my favorite shows that we do every year. So
what about the other thing we do at the start of the year?
The predictions?
Yeah.
We did get an email about that. I was kind of hoping
the disaster segment.
I was hoping to just dodge that bullet.
No, I think it's tradition at this point.
No, it's January. Things will be slow. I'm sure we will make time for predictions, even though I might
say that there's gonna be a Nintendo Direct.
I might not want to, but we'll do it. We'll do it. Don't worry. But not right now. Right now, we're gonna close this episode up. Bid thee good night. And we'll say see you next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Au revoir.
Oh, well, what am I supposed to say now? Goodbye?
There you go.